It's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Hi, everyone. This is Vince Ferlicci filling in for Kevin O'Neill on Capital Thinking. Today, we've got a great show. We're going to talk about, for about the first half of the show, about patent issues regarding ICANN's new top-level domain name process that's ongoing with three experts in the field from Patent Bugs. And then we're going to shift and go north to Canada and talk about the class action system in Canada, doing business in Canada if you're an American company, and then also talk about employment issues dealing with, again, doing business in Canada. So we happy to have Deborah Lodge here and two colleagues of hers from Patent Bugs.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
A little technical difficulty here on my end.
Can you hear me?
Is everyone there?
We're here.
Oh, great. So several months ago, we had a segment detailing how companies could apply for generic top-level domains like .radio. Here to give us that update, as I said, are three Patent Bug attorneys, Mark Ellison from the TechCom Group, partner Deborah Lodge, and associate Chris Adams from the Intellectual Property Department. Deborah specializes in IP, privacy, and internet law. Among her diverse clients are financial institutions, communications entities, private equity firms, trade associations, e-commerce companies, and technology pioneers. With her broad legal experience and practical business perspective, Deborah helps clients navigate the shoals of business regulations and achieve their strategic goals through the management of their IP and other assets. Mark uses more than three decades of industry experience to advise technology, communications, and utilities clients regarding a broad array of legal, regulatory, and business issues. Mark helps both for-profit and non-profit tech and communications entities with business transactions, licensing agreements, general corporate matters, regulatory activities, and government affairs. Chris assists clients with patent prosecution, licensing and litigation matters using his technical knowledge and experience in various computer hardware, software, and internet technologies, as well as chemistry. So, Mark, I understand that there's this race that's going on to get something called GTLDs. What is that about?
Well, GTLDs are generic top-level domains. As everyone knows, for years and years, we've had the standard top-level domains, which are the .com, .org, and some of the country-specific .canada, .ca, .australia, and so on. Well, for several years, ICANN, which is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, has been working to open up the system to allow entities to have different top-level domain names that are either generic, like .banking, .shoes, .money, or that are company-specific, such as .microsoft or .ford. So this process opened up in January of this year. The application process was supposed to close in the middle of this month on April 12th, but there have been some technical glitches in the application process, so it's been extended. It's an idea that's very attractive to companies that want to establish their own registry and have a dot name that is specific to their corporate name or product, and also for entrepreneurs, someone who might want to have dot shoes, for example, or dot drugs, something of that nature. So it's been quite an interesting process, and I'm sure Deborah can give you some more details about what's gone on here in the past few months.
Well, Deborah, let me ask you a question. Why did this program get started? It seems like, you know, with .com and with .net, or frankly just .com being sort of the domain name of choice now since the Internet really has come full force. And why did this even get started?
Well, you know, there are lots of .com names out there, and, to a large extent, they were running out of .com opportunities. And the theory was that by opening up, the Internet for these new generic TLDs, that innovation and competition would be encouraged, and the Internet would be allowed to develop more fully. And, you know, needless to say, the winners of these top-level domains will be able to use these new domains in many ways. You know, it can be, you know, either for their own businesses and customers, or, you know, depending on the application kind, they can be opened up to, you know, many other kinds of communities and, you know, uses. Because the winners are going to be, you know, registries themselves, and they will have to take charge of deciding, you know, who's going to get the lower level domain names, because we're talking at the top, as Mark said, we're talking about, you know, analogies to the .com space. So there will be, like, you know, if I had Lodge, or if I had .lodge, there will be a, you know, Deborah.lodge and a, you know, Sally.lodge, and it can go on and on and on.
Got it. So, Chris, so I understand you're a technical expert and you're a patent attorney, and just got a few questions, just sort of the basics for those that might not, you know, be sort of in the weeds like you all are on this issue. So, who manages all these top-level domains? I think we've kind of really covered what they are, but who manages these?
Typically, you have a registry operator who manages each of the top-level domains. They ensure that they maintain the registry database, which includes domain names, and you often have several registrars who are authorized to register a domain name for an applicant.
Got it. And this term ICANN, what is ICANN, and why is it involved in this process?
ICANN is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. It is a not-for-profit organization that regulates and governs the domain name space. ICANN coordinates assignment of domain name spaces, and it also is responsible for ensuring the security and stability of the Internet addresses and protocols. ICANN is currently overseeing this new GTLD process.
Got it. So Mark, so I'm, you know, sitting here thinking like an entrepreneur a little bit. What's the application process here? Can I just tell ICANN that I want to register .vince or .vince is a, you know, a great government affairs professional? Or, I mean, how does that work?
Well, you can try. It's actually a very involved and expensive process. First of all, the application fee alone with ICANN is $185,000. Per name, there is a 300-page application guidebook. The applications themselves are very, very extensive. They really dig into the background and whether you have the ability to maintain the registry. It's a very rigorous process that they go through. And then operating the registry, once you do get the name, if you survive the process and are not challenged, which we'll talk about today, some of the objection processes, it's a very expensive operation to maintain the registry name so that you can use the secondary domains and get them registered for use on the Internet. So yes, you can apply for Vince or whatever you want, but it's not an easy hoop to jump through.
Got it. So that being the case, have there been a lot of applications, Deborah? And sort of what's the status of where we are in the process at this point?
That's a great question, Vince, and you know, very timely. As Chris or Mark mentioned, you know, the application process started in January. It was supposed to have closed in April, on April 12th. But then a, quote, glitch developed, and ICANN stopped the application process so that the glitch could be fixed. And just yesterday, ICANN gave another update that said, gee, you know, we're not going to start the process again until at least May 8th, and that's because the glitch involved an ability of other applicants to see the data that was submitted by, you know, their competitor applicants. And ICANN's going through and notifying the affected applications. So there's been, you know, some delay, and it's been quite embarrassing, I think, to ICANN and others, but I'm sure it will be fixed. One big issue here is that everything has been very confidential. No one really knows how many applications have been submitted or what they're for. And that's why everyone had been looking forward to what's called Reveal Day, because on Reveal Day, the public, well, ICANN will post the names of the applicants and certain public information, including the desired top-level domain names, which are called strings in this process. But that's been delayed. Reveal Day what did not happen on May 1st, and, you know, the earliest it can probably happen is, you know, towards the end of May, because when the application process starts up again, applicants are going to be given at least 5 business days to complete and check their applications.
Got it. So about the glitch, though, and that doesn't sound like a tech concept. Chris, can you go more into that, the glitch issue, and
sure.
What that means now?
Based on our understanding of the information that ICANN has posted, it appears that several registered users were able to view file names and usernames for other applicants. Based on the statistics provided by ICANN, we believe there were 455 instances of this that occurred. ICANN provided the following data points: that about 105 applicants may have viewed the file names and usernames of other applicants. Since ICANN took the system down April 12th, it was helpful, especially for us, some of us who were supervising the process, because we could catch our breath, but unfortunately it's taken about a month, and as Deborah suggested earlier, we're getting quite anxious since it seems as if the entire process has been significantly delayed.
Now, why is it important that people got to see that list? Like, how does that affect the process?
Well, we believe that, as Deborah mentioned earlier, some of this information is confidential or proprietary information, and
yeah.
If a competitor or some other applicant has access to your data, they potentially have enough time when the system comes back online to make additional edits to their applications before
Got
the
it.
Application.
Chris, we're going to break away for a second, and we're going to come back and talk more about objecting to these potential names that are submitted, and we'll talk more about this. Thanks.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball,
off the glass,
football,
come on,
golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back, everybody. Vince Ferlicci here, filling in for Kevin O'Neill today on May 3rd. I'm with Deborah Lodge and two of her colleagues from Patton Boggs. Deborah, continuing this conversation about ICANN, top-level domain names, and this process of new dot whatevers that are going to come out here for a number of folks that are going to want to either use their brand or try to get in someone's space. Let's pick up where we left off about the process here. We were talking about the glitch in the system and maybe people getting an opportunity to peek into what people have been applying for. So the system's now offline, expected to come back online soon. So then what happens when the sort of the assembly line starts back up on this process then?
Yes, we are all looking forward to reveal day. At some point it will dawn, although I must note that, you know, there are already calls for congressional investigations into, you know, why this glitch happened and what its effect was. But soon, you know, there will be, more will be revealed, literally, about 2 weeks after the application window closes. And at that point, as I mentioned, ICANN will release publicly the names of the applicants and their chosen strings or, you know, generic top-level domains. And at that point, ICANN will post online the public portions of the applications that they received. As I mentioned, no one knows yet, you know, exactly how many applications there are. Yesterday, in its updated report, ICANN revealed that there were 1,268 registered users, and that the, you know, at the time of the glitch, there were 95,000 file attachments in the system. Now, that doesn't mean 95,000 generic top-level domains, because each application has multiple file attachments. So it's kind of hard to determine exactly how many applications there are. But reveal day is really important because not only will everyone then know what top-level domain names are being sought, but also it triggers certain very critical periods in the ICANN review process. On reveal day will be triggered what is called the Government Advisory Committee Early Warning Period, a comment period, and an objection period. And we'll go into all of those in a second, but it also starts the next level of the review process, and the first part of that is going to be called the batching process. And that's a little technical, so I hope Chris will help us out in determining or explaining what the batching process entails.
Okay. Well, I do want to hear about it. I'm just wondering, first of all, who all these ICANN people are and where they are around the world. It's kind of an interesting setup here. But nonetheless, that's just a layman's view. Chris, on that point, tell us about the batching process now that we're, you know, that when that hits the assembly line. What is that about? What does that mean?
Good question, Kevin. ICANN has indicated that if it receives more than 500 GTLD applications, which we think might be the case based on the statistics Deborah just provided, ICANN will process the application in batches. The first batch will be limited to 500 applications, and each subsequent batch will be limited to 400 applications. Our understanding of the batching process is it is similar to digital archery. First, the applicant would have to set the target, and then they would try to hit the target with as much as accuracy as they can. So, for example, the applicant would log into the system and select a date and time, and then on that particular date and time, the applicant would log into the system and hit a button as close as possible to the time selected. The difference between the proposed target and the actual submission time is what would rank the applicant, what would identify the applicant's batch.
Okay. Wow, that sounds pretty interesting for a process. So what are the periods, Deborah, back to the timeline on this, what are the periods triggered by this reveal day?
Okay, so one of the period of most interest to, you know, the trademark community is the objections period. That's because when that period opens, you know, anyone who owns a trademark or a legal right will have a chance to object if they think that one of the proposed top-level domain names would infringe or hurt their rights. There are several kinds of objections that can be made. And Mark, can you just delineate and describe the basic kinds of objections that can be made at that point?
Sure, Deborah. Yeah, there are basically four kinds of objections that a party can make once they see a name that they're concerned about. And that's, you know, one is called a string confusion objection. And that really is similar to, you know, a challenge under trademark or something like that, where there could be confusion as to the name and the use of it. There's a legal rights objection, and that is one where there is a specific objection based on trademark, trade name, that has been registered by another party. So if somebody tried to use Dot Ford, for example, Ford Motor Company probably would object based on legal rights, but that's also a generic name, so they may also come under the confusion basis. There's rights to object based on public interest, where there is someone seeking to use a name that perhaps goes against the generally accepted legal norms of society or morality or public order. And then finally, there is an objection, a community objection, and that would typically be where somebody is trying to use perhaps a tribal name, a country name, something that applies to a specific community of people, and for some reason that community of people does not want to have that name used by the particular applicant. Perhaps they want to use it themselves. So it will be an interesting process. This is something that hasn't been done before. It's going to be a real challenge, I think, for intellectual property attorneys and copyright and trademark attorneys to pursue this. But it is going to be probably the most important aspect of this for the applicant to get through if they really want to use their name.
Yeah, it sounds like it's such a just fraught with just possible, you know, people squatting and, you know, trying to do other sort of shenanigans. Deborah, so how are you and your colleagues and those in your space here preparing for this reveal day?
Preparing for reveal day is already underway, needless to say, because, you know, devising a strategy for handling and dealing with the new top-level domain names is a key issue for many of our clients, particularly those with large trademark portfolios. And so as a practical level, you know, we're extending our trademark watch services for our trademark clients, and we're working on organizing reviews of, you know, the names, marks, et cetera, that our companies are interested in. And in this, I do want to give a plug for CSC. We've been partnering with them on several ICANN-related matters, and we expect to continue doing so. They've been immensely helpful, particularly, you know, with their, you know, watching service and some of the, you know, technical issues in the applications. And we think that clients may want to object if they see that other strings proposed are using brand names or similar names, and, you know, having opposition kind of objections is definitely a possibility. And there's another way that companies can protect their trademarks as well, but that's a little bit down the road in this, you know, ICANN development system, because there will be a trademark clearinghouse that will be established, and that will be used basically, hopefully, as a screen, so that when, you know, the subdomain names come in, they will be allocated in a way that will preserve trademark owners' rights. But this whole system has been one that has been objected to by some in the trademark community because it was not felt that ICANN had enough traps and guards in place to protect trademarks. And that's why this clearinghouse is going to be developed, and some of these other issues have been, you know, raised in order to protect trademarks. I should note that filing an objection on a legal rights basis is not going to be cheap. It's likely to cost at least, $10,000 as a filing fee for the opposer. Chris, WIPO has been appointed as the arbiter for these disputes, correct?
Correct, for the legal rights objections, but we also have other entities that manage other types of objections.
That's correct. Whoever is going to decide the merits of the objections is going to depend on the nature of the objection. And, you know, we're focusing on the legal rights one now. String confusion is another issue that can be, that's sort of an applicant versus applicant, you know, if both have come up with, you know, dot Deborah or something like that, then there's going to have to be a system of disputing those. And I'll tell you, Vince, we have so much to talk about, and there are so many other issues that are raised. I hope that we will all be able to return soon. And I guess, you know, I know we're nearing the end of this segment, so I would like, would it be possible for Mark just to, you know, give his summary comments in terms of what's going to happen next?
That'd be great, Mark. Why don't you wrap this up for us? We've got about 30 seconds.
I think everybody can pick up from this that it is a very, very complex, confusing process. We didn't even touch on things like what's going to happen with search engine results when this is all done. How's Google and others going to cope with this? So there are additional topics. This has been great. Hope we can come back in the near future, especially after Reveal Day, and talk some more about what's going to happen.
Great. Well, I know they're going to try to get you on next week to try to continue the conversation, and maybe a reveal day will happen between now and then, and there'll be more revealed. That sounds like an extremely complicated next 7 months and beyond for not only the lawyers involved, the companies involved, but, you know, the public at large. So thank you very much for your time today, everybody. And we'll be back here in Capital Thinking in a couple of minutes, and we're going to go north of the border and talk about trans-border legal issues, class actions in Canada, employment issues in Canada, doing business in Canada. This is Capital Thinking.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoy Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoy Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattenboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattenboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hi, welcome back to Capital Thinking. It's Vince Ferlicci here, filling in for Kevin O'Neill today. In our third segment today, we're going north of the border, and we're going to talk about doing business in Canada, how to handle class actions with Jill Yates. And Jill is a partner in the litigation group of a firm in Vancouver named McCarthy Tetrault. She has experience in commercial trial and appellate legal issues, particularly in the area of class action, also real estate litigation, professional liability, and products liability. Jill's appeared at all levels of court in British Columbia and at arbitral hearings, and she's also a contributor to Defending Class Actions in Canada. Pretty straightforward book, and now in its third edition. Jill, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Vince. Great to be here.
I hope that the Canadian public aren't forming a class action against the U.S. for not allowing any Canadian team to be represented at this point in the NHL playoffs. But I noticed Vancouver was the lone Canadian team, but here in Washington, D.C., we're pretty excited about the Capitals.
Absolutely.
It would have been fun to have a Washington-Ottawa kind of matchup. But nonetheless, so the third edition of this book, Defending Class Actions in Canada, just came out, and you were part of that. Your firm was part of issuing that out. So what does this cover for those of us maybe reading that here in the States?
Well, this new edition is a great resource for both class action defendants across Canada, but also for U.S.-based defendants in Canadian class actions, and certainly for U.S. attorneys whose clients may be facing Canadian class actions. We provide detailed coverage of each class action jurisdiction in the country, because unfortunately, unlike in the U.S., we don't have a way to tie together different actions. Each one can potentially proceed independently in each of our 10 jurisdictions. The publication also provides a primer on the steps involved in class actions up here, and we comment on prevention as well as defending, settling, contesting, all those kinds of things, and an overview of important recent trends in class actions, which include ones that are occurring across provincial and international borders, and particularly across borders between Canada and the U.S.
So on that point, as far as what's occurring, what are the current hot areas of class actions in Canada right now?
Well, we're really focused on antitrust cases right now. In Canada, we call them competition law cases, and a lot of them end up being copycat cases from things that are going on in the U.S. So those are very topical. We're also seeing some securities class actions that are similar to what's been happening in the U.S. for some time, and we consistently see a lot of product liability cases, including consumer advocacy type groups bringing actions. So those are main areas. In our particular case up here, McCarthy Tetro is doing a lot of work with significant class actions involving financial institutions. So everybody likes to pick on the banks, and that's no different in Canada than it is in the U.S.
Sure. So you mentioned that there were some similarities, but some unique differences in the Canadian U.S. class action regimes. Can you tell us how similar and different those are, and as well as the differences in the legal cultures in Canada?
Absolutely. We actually, we here in Canada originally based our class action legislation on the federal Rule 23 in the U.S. So the starting point was the same, but there were very deliberate differences that were made to the Canadian legislation, and that includes modifying and really lowering the bar on a number of the requirements for what's called certification. So in a class action, the point at which it goes from being an ordinary piece of litigation, an ordinary action, to being a class action is what's called certification, and that's where a judge decides whether or not certain requirements have been met. And so we started from looking at the American legislation, the Rule 23, and then modifying a few things. And one of them, for example, is that in the U.S. you have a requirement called numerosity. There has to be a significant size of people that want to litigate something in the form of the class action. In Canada, we decided that we didn't want to go with that. Instead, there just has to be two or more people. So it's easier to form a class in Canada from that perspective. There's also something in the U.S. called typicality, that particular claims have to be typical of all of the people in the class. And we modified that a little bit, too, to do what's called preferability. So a judge has to look at the proposed action and decide that this particular form, the class action form, is preferable to any other way of trying to resolve the claims. And then finally, there's something called predominance, and that is the issues that the group has in common have to predominate over individual issues. And we again look at that from the perspective of preferability. So there are real similarities, but certainly businesses in the U.S. who are used to how things are done in American class actions will be familiar with the overall context, but there are certainly particular differences that they need to be aware of and that they need to understand, because things do play out fairly differently in Canada now than they do in the U.S. In terms of legal culture, in the U.S. you guys have jury trials that really cause us some surprise up here. There's all kinds of crazy things that happen. We don't have those in class actions in Canada, and so that makes things a little more predictable from a business's perspective. We also have judicial oversight of the contingency fee arrangements, and so the awards that the plaintiffs lawyers get up here tend to be relatively modest by American standards. And finally, we don't have treble damages like many different types of class actions do in the U.S., and so the awards tend to be smaller. All that said, certification is potentially easier to achieve in Canada, and so although certain things are more palatable for businesses up here, there are other aspects that are less so.
So you mentioned no jury trial, for instance. So does that mean that there's just one judge then oversees the entire process, or is there a panel of judges, or how does that work?
There is one judge. It doesn't necessarily have to be the same judge at every stage, but that's exactly right. There is a single judge that will do the case managing and will do the certification hearing, and then potentially a different judge will hear a trial on the merits if it goes that way. There is some variation between the different jurisdictions in Canada and Quebec. You get a single judge, the same individual judge will preside over the entire thing, and then it's only if you go to appeal that you would have a panel of judges, that you would have three judges that would look at whatever issue has been appealed.
That's interesting. So we only got a couple of minutes left here, but one thing I wanted to go back on was the comment you made about copycat cases. So on that point, so how do Canadian and U.S. class actions influence each other, whether something's filed first in Canada and then maybe then there's a reciprocation in the U.S., or again, something more often than not, there's a U.S. case, and then there's a copycat. Maybe if there's an example you could throw out as well, maybe of a current nature of a case that we might be reading about in the journal,
Yeah, it has been, what we have been seeing is that something will go first in the U.S. and will then come up to Canada, and that happens very often. The easiest example of that will be that there'll be antitrust activity in a particular industry, like, for example, you know, product like chocolate or hydrogen peroxide, and that will lead to even potentially a plea in an antitrust proceeding in the U.S., and that will spin off, you know, monetary-related cases both in the U.S. and then subsequently in Canada that both look to that guilty plea as a way of proving some of the issues in the case. So that's what we have been seeing for a number of years. There's been a pretty dramatic change, though, in terms of certification standards in the U.S. with the United States Supreme Court's Walmart decision in 2011. You know, your courts now can look at the merits at certification. They can look at all kinds of things that our courts aren't able to look at certification. And what that means is that it's a lot easier to get certified in Canada than it is in the U.S. And so we're thinking that might, you know, for strategically minded plaintiff's lawyers, that might lead to a bit of a change in terms of whether things go first in Canada, just because the ability to get certified is now very, very different.
Although you said the fees are held in check much more in Canada than in the States, right?
They are, absolutely, and that obviously this is all about cash, and your economy is bigger than ours. Your population obviously is a lot bigger than ours, and the cash that's involved is a lot more. So you're absolutely right. That might tend the other way, but there are protocols now. The ABA and the Canadian Bar Association have a protocol to cooperate in respect of judicial communication and notice for cross-border settlements, for cross-border settlement approvals, and you know, paying out classes that go across borders, those kinds of things. And so I think that, as I say, strategically minded plaintiffs' counsels are going to be looking at this as a real opportunity to look at the more lenient certification test in Canada paired with some cooperation in terms of cross-border settlements and classes, and see if they can't, you know, take advantage of the much bigger pot south of the border and the more lenient legal test north of the border.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. It's been great to learn about what's going on up there and sort of what might transpire with sort of creative use of the law and trans-border-wise. So, Jill, thank you for being with us on Capital Thinking, and look forward to having you back again, and have a good day in Vancouver.
Thanks very much, Vince.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back, everyone, to Capital Thinking. Vince Frelici here filling in this week for Kevin O'Neill. In our last segment today, we're going to stay north of the border, and we're going to change the conversation from the uniqueness of class action litigation in Canada to uniqueness of employment law. So if you're a U.S. company thinking about doing business in Canada, or you're doing business in Canada, you may be aware of some of the uniquenesses of labor law. So joining us is Donovan Plump. And Donovan, welcome to the show.
Hello, Vince. Thanks.
So Donovan's a partner in the Labor and Employment and Pensions Benefit Executive Compensation Groups in, again, McCarthy Tétrault in Vancouver. Donovan's appeared as counsel in matters before the British Columbia Labor Relations Board, the Canada Industrial Relations Board, the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal, the Supreme Court of British Columbia, and grievance arbitration panels. He's also assisted clients in drafting employment contracts, policies, as well as advising on a wide variety of workplace issues, including but not limited to privacy, disability, and the application and interpretation of collective agreements. So Donovan, tell us, for those of us listening here in the States, what level of government has the most control over labor and employment matters in Canada? Here it's the Department of Labor, EEOC, and so just give us a sense of that, first of all, lay of the land.
Well, this is something that can be surprising and occasionally frustrating for U.S. counsel doing business in Canada, in the labor context at least. Down there, I know you have the National Labor Relations Board and federal legislation governing the country's unionized workforce. Up here, about 90% of our workforce is regulated almost entirely by the provincial governments. Each province in the labor realm has its own labor relations board, and each province in the employment side has its own Employment or Labor Standards Act. So in terms of deciding what rules apply to your employees, it'll depend largely on which province they're in, unless the industry in which you're operating is a federally regulated industry. And that's only about 10% of the workforce, and those are in such organizations as banks, interprovincial undertakings like pipelines, shipping, interprovincial trucking. So by and large, the provincial legislation in the province in which you're operating is going to be of significant importance in deciding what applies to your employees.
Interesting. So when it comes to employers and how they manage their workforce, can employers in Canada or anyone employing a Canadian citizen terminate an employee at an at-will basis like they can in the United States without severance?
And that's a second major difference, and the answer is no. In Canada, unless there's legal justification for the employee termination for cause, or unless the employee has a written employment agreement with very clear terms setting out a termination package, then the courts will imply at common law a term of reasonable notice of termination into every contract. And reasonable notice is something that is fixed and assessed on a case-by-case basis. So let's say you have a 50-year-old manager who's worked for a company for 20 years. He could have a range of common law reasonable notice awarded to him if he went all the way to court, to the tune of 18 to 20 or even more months, depending on how the job market was. The four factors that a court considers in assessing a reasonable notice period are age, length of service, possibility of reemployment, and nature of the position. Generally, although there is some diverging law on this, higher status positions will receive longer notice periods. The maximum length that can be awarded in British Columbia is 24 months. It's important to note that those notice periods are subject to an employee's duty to look for other work, and if they find other work during the period, then any amount they earn will be deducted from that. but it is a significant liability that U.S. employers are often surprised by when they come up here. In terms of managing it, it is possible, as I've mentioned, to exclude or to set the period of reasonable notice by agreement, provided that it meets or exceeds the minimum standards in each province or federally as applicable. So I would advise the counsel when they're hiring an employee to consider consulting with counsel up here and entering into an agreement that limits the reasonable notice period to something that's acceptable to them. And those agreements have to be carefully drafted to make sure that the common law implied term is properly excluded.
That's a lot of detail there and a lot of differences. Another issue that I think employers might be thinking about is the issue of wages and sort of overtime and dealing with sort of differences there. Are there differences there, and how is overtime managed in Canada?
Overtime is applicable to every employee unless they're expressly excluded by the applicable legislation. And my understanding is that in the U.S., it's possible to establish a policy or enter into a contract to determine whether overtime is payable in some circumstances. Is that, I believe, I don't want to misspeak because I'm not positive on that. But I have had situations where U.S. clients have called and said, well, we view this person as exempt in the U.S. because they're paid a salary. Whereas up here in Canada, under, for example, the British Columbia Employment Standards Act, there has to be a specific exemption allowing an employer to not pay overtime. The most common one is for managers. So if someone's in a managerial position, a true managerial position, it's not just the title, then they'll be excluded from the hours of work and overtime regulations of the Employment Standards Act. And there's some other unique exemptions. For example, in British Columbia, we have an exemption for high technology professionals. So software developers and engineers and people like that, there's an exception under the regulations for that. So it's worth a call to see whether or not your employees can be exempt, because there's a number of categories. Lawyers, unfortunately, are completely exempt from the Employment Standards Act, so but there may be others that apply.
Now, on the just out of curiosity, on the provincial oversight of these different rules on overtime, are there major differences between provinces and how they manage that, or is what you just discussed, particularly the British Columbia model, is that pretty much the standard across the board with all the provinces?
I think there's more similarities than differences in terms of overtime. Each province will have a Labor Standards or an Employment Standards Act that has fairly similar provisions. The threshold is somewhat different. I think in Ontario, for example, it's 44 hours in a week. In British Columbia, it's 8 hours a day or 40 hours a week before overtime kicks in. So there are minor differences. So you'd be advised to consult counsel in the specific province where you're operating.
Yeah. What about the, obviously we've, since the 90s, we've had the Americans with Disability Act here dealing with access and also, obviously provisions for employees who are disabled. How does Canadian law deal with employees and the relationship between employees and employers who are disabled? What kind of obligations do those employees have?
Yeah, that's a huge issue, which is constantly being litigated. Every province and the federal government has a human rights tribunal or commission, which is an administrative body, and depending upon the federal government has a commission process which investigates and screens complaints before it goes to a tribunal. The British Columbia and several other provinces have a tribunal, which is a direct access model where a complainant can just bring a complaint that, for example, they've been discriminated against in their job by being terminated or demoted due to a disability or other enumerated grounds. And disability is the most commonly litigated one, I would say. And if you have an employee who is disabled, you need to accommodate them in the workplace up to the point of quote-unquote undue hardship, which is not a bright-line test or prescribed standard. It's decided on the facts of each case. So that is something that employers often struggle with. When do you meet the test of undue hardship? And I understand that it's a little more clear in terms of when you reach that obligation in the U.S.
And so how is this failure to accommodate and enforce them?
Mm-hmm. It's typically not through a court action. It's typically through a complaint to one of the administrative tribunals, and they have fairly sweeping powers to award remedies. I guess, for example, they could order reinstatement. They could order significant back pay. In British Columbia, they can award damages for injury to dignity. But those damages are generally moderate. Like, we're not talking a runaway jury award where you're going to be paying millions of dollars in damages. A damage for injury to dignity award is going to be usually in the realm of $10,000 to $20,000 on top of whatever damages are awarded. So while the process, there's no cost if the complainant loses and it generates a lot of complaints, you're generally not looking at a scary, uncertain jury award scenario. There's generally constrained by the previous jurisprudence in terms of what they can award.
Very interesting. And, you know, one of the other things I was thinking about was the human rights tribunals. I mean, do these protect from other things besides discrimination based on disability, or is there a ring fence around just that issue?
Well, that's a very good question, because in each province, this is where there are some differences. There's a number of enumerated grounds under the human rights legislation in each province. For example, disability, that's a common one. Gender, you can't discriminate on those grounds. They differ slightly in other respects. In British Columbia, you can't discriminate in employment against someone because they've been convicted of a criminal or summary conviction offense, whereas in Alberta, they don't have that similar prohibition. So in British Columbia, if someone's been convicted of a criminal offense, you'll have to demonstrate that the conduct underlying the offense is, or the offense itself, is related to their proposed employment.
Well, Donovan, it's been a pleasure to have you on Capital Thinking and talk about these issues. Thanks for informing us. Everybody, that was Donovan Plomp of McCarthy Tetrault in Vancouver. Thanks for joining us at Capital Thinking, and we'll see you again next Thursday.
Thank you, Vince.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.